From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Near East Ridge.
Sunset.
East Side.
San Francisco.
Border of Venus.
San Jose.
Coming up, the politics of choosing to be childless.
I remember a couple years ago mentioning to my grandmother that I wasn't going to have children, and she went off the handle. She was not happy with that.
Then, how you can have a life filled with children without having your own.
When I was a kid, I secretly thought that people with mothers were sissies. They had to take baths every day, and they needed to be coddled when they fell off their bikes.
And we'll hear about a Richmond exhibit that explores childcare's wartime origins.
That was something very special. All of the kids knew that they belonged to somebody.
Parenting and unparenting, today on Cross Currents. Birth rates in California are at a record low, according to the most recent census data. Our birth rates are lower than the national average, and in San Francisco, they're lower still. The drop in birth rates has been described as marking a historic transition for the state, but it's still difficult to pinpoint why it's happening. There are lots of reasons, including career choices and infertility, but some women are simply choosing not to have children.
More and more married couples in this country are choosing to go childless.
I think it's incredibly selfish to not have children.
Having kids equals a happy marriage. It makes the family complete.
People are not reproducing. They're too busy having a good time. All you got to do is look at the...
The number of child-free couples will increase 44%.
Producer Meta Jensen took a look at this decision to go childless in a short radio documentary she co-produced called Living Without. Here's Meta.
The Holy Bible, chapter 1, verse 28. And God blessed them, and God said unto them, Be fruitful, and multiply and replenish the earth. And so they did. But a lot of water has run under the bridge since God gave his first commandment. Today, nearly 20% of American women end their childbearing years without giving birth to a child. That is 1 in 5, compared with 1 in 10 in the 1970s. But beyond the demographic statistics, the real story lies with the people who have chosen not to have children.
My mom's friend Sue would actually give me a dollar to hang out with her kid.
This is Heather Kennedy. She's 36 years old and lives in Half Moon Bay, California.
If I get money from it, then I guess I was okay with it.
She knew from the age of 8 that she did not want children.
Pretty much every single OBGYN that I've ever had, I have asked about getting sterilized.
But the answer was always no. You're too young. You might change your mind.
They tend not to take you seriously. It's really frustrating.
But Heather's family took her seriously.
I remember a couple years ago mentioning to my grandmother that I wasn't going to have children, and she went off the handle. She was not happy with that. She was like, don't say that. That's a horrible thing to say. You don't mean that. Of course you want to have children. You'll regret it if you don't. You need to have kids. And so I just kind of chose to drop it. No point in arguing with a 90-year-old woman.
Heather's grandmother was from another time, back before women entered the workforce.
According to a new study, women held 49% of the nation's 132 million jobs in June.
Before they got college degrees.
Today, women outnumber men in college. That's a stunning statistic.
And before they had the option to protect themselves from unwanted pregnancies.
The birth control pill turns 50 this year. It is the most widely used method of contraception.
Amy Blackstone, a professor in sociology at Maine University, explains.
Since the 1970s, I think that we've seen a number of cultural changes that meant that for women, having a child became a choice.
The choice is evident. In 2011, after the financial crisis, American birth rates fell to the lowest ever in U.S. history. For the first time in recent memory, Americans were having fewer babies than the French or British. There are now more households with dogs than children in the U.S. But Amy Blackstone says you won't see these trends reflected in popular media.
There are tons of Hollywood films that I think glamorize parenthood, from Baby Mama.
I'm 37 and I want a baby.
To Knocked
so
Up.
Get married and have babies.
Parenthood.
Eat you for lunch.
I'm gonna eat you for lunch.
The message is that the most rewarding and most meaningful thing that a person can do is bear a child.
My mom's having a baby.
When people hear about this trend of more and more people not having children, some of the questions that they ask are, who's going to take care of them when they get older? that the child-free are selfish, that they're materialistic. They must hate children, and why do they hate children?
That's not how Rachel Hall sees herself. She's from Berkeley, she's 48 years old, and doesn't have kids. She doesn't hate them either. But since she was a girl, she could tell she wasn't drawn to them like other girls her age.
Some kids, like my sister, for example, loved children. My mother, when she was a kid, loved to babysit, always knew that she wanted to have kids and she ended four of them. That was not me. It was some kind of innate nature in me, perhaps, that I wasn't drawn to them.
Rachel Hall pursued a career as a software developer and nurtured her life by volunteering at animal shelters. In her late 20s, she found her big passion. Running.
It became an important part of my life, you know, as a way to work off some steam and be out in nature up in the hills. I started having these dreams. I would really desperately want to go for a run. You know, I had my running gear on, and then I would get to the point like, oh, I'm going to head out the door, and then realize I can't leave because there's this infant here that I'm responsible for. I remember just being kind of panic in this state of kind of disbelief, like, what am I going to do? And then I would wake up and I would just have this huge sense of relief that it was just a dream.
Rachel had to figure out if she would regret not having children. What about when she was older? What if her feelings changed? Maybe Kelly Flynn would know.
My name is Kelly Flynn.
She's a 54-year-old retired teacher from Michigan. A ruptured appendix in her 30s meant that she and her husband could never have kids on their own. She says they chose not to adopt because of her husband's age. So, instead of being a mother, she enjoyed the benefits of being without children.
I had the freedom to quit my job when I got tired of it.
She published two books, the most recent being A Teacher's Lounge Uncensored.
I didn't have to worry about money because I didn't have to save for a child's braces or a college education or a wedding. 95% of the time, I don't even think about it anymore. It's just those certain times when I see a mother and daughter together and they're holding hands, doing something mother-daughterish, that I feel kind of a pang and think, oh, gosh, you know, I sure would love to have had that.
As Kelly Flynn grew older, a new concern arose.
When my dad became sick and started needing a lot of help, you know, I thought about how much I was doing for him, and it just kind of hit me, like, well, who's going to do that for me? I mean, there are fabulous caregivers out there, but I guess my concern is that they won't know me like my own children would. I knew that he was a construction worker all his life, you know, quite macho. So I helped him kind of keep his increasing frailty hidden from his friends. And a stranger doesn't know those things about you like your own child would. And they might not care so much about honoring them.
So, back to Rachel Hall, the runner with the baby nightmare.
Did you do anything special?
Reptiles.
Here she is, talking to Elan, her nephew. And she also has a niece that she babysits every once in a while. She even gets mistaken as their mom when they're at the park.
I like King Cobra.
Really? King Cobra?
Sometimes I just kind of tickle that people actually assume that I'm the mother. Because I know inside that that's just so far away from the reality.
There's no way of knowing if Rachel Hall will end up having some of the same doubts that Kelly Flynn described. But for now, she stands by her decision not to have children of her own.
I think honestly that there's an element of it that I'm kind of proud of it, that, you know, I made that decision not to have kids and I'm totally okay with it. And there are people out there and I'm one of them. And we're not odd or, you know, there's nothing wrong with us. Some people just don't want to have them and that's okay.
For Cross Currents, I'm Mette Jensen.
That piece was co-produced by Gabe Pinnell and Anthony Pisatella. They're students from the Broadcast and Electronic Communication Arts Department at San Francisco State University. This is Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Ben Trefney, and we're talking about babies. Babies, babies, babies. Scroll down your Facebook feed and it might seem like they're everywhere, but the number of women actively choosing not to have children, it's on the rise. What does it mean to be a woman who doesn't play this most traditional of female roles? What happens to that maternal instinct we hear so much about? In this next piece, KALW's Julie Kane explores her own decision to stay childless.
I keep getting invited to births. I even get repeat invitations. So far, I've seen 4 babies come into the world, and I've cut 2 of their umbilical cords. The oldest of these kids is a 14-year-old girl who's super sassy, and the youngest is a little boy who's just learning how to crawl. Because I've done it so many times, the parents-to-be tell me that they feel really reassured having me in the room.
What a pretty baby.
You could say I've become something of an expert on the precision cult of baby making.
What is it? What is it?
It's a girl.
The fact is that I have never given birth, have no children of my own, and I don't intend to ever reproduce. It's not that I waited, expecting to have kids after I got a career off the ground, only to find out I couldn't get pregnant. And it's not that I don't like children or get creeped out by babies. I dig kids, and they dig me.
Get under the covers, please. There you go. Pippi goes to a
coffee. I'm a 40-year-old woman who is childless by choice.
Tommy and Annika's mother had a...
I grew up in a bachelor's house. I'm the only child of a single father. And this means that, unlike most of my childhood friends, I kissed dogs right on the mouth. My favorite toy for an entire year was a screwdriver. I carried it everywhere. I even slept with it sometimes. When I was a kid, I secretly thought that people with mothers were sissies. They had to take baths every day, and they needed to be coddled when they fell off their bikes. But while I scoffed at the gentler and generally more sanitary lives of mothered children, I also really longed for a woman's touch in my life, an initiation into the mysterious world of curling irons and eyeshadow. Sometimes I watch my mom friends with a kind of experiential envy. I'll never know what it feels like to have a baby kicking inside of me, and I'll never know what it feels like to breastfeed an infant. It feels like a kind of disconnect from the world of women. But I do know what it feels like to hold someone's finger while they walk down the street. I go to dance recitals. I take sobbing, angst-ridden adolescent phone calls late into the night. I change diapers and I give baths. I say no. Although, not as often as I say yes.
Shushu sleeps with me.
Miel is one of the kids I saw born. She's 6 years old now, and recently I was babysitting her, and when it got time for bed, she started instructing me into this very elaborate bedtime ritual she has where she has to individually swaddle each one of her dolls and stuffed animals and then put them all to bed.
Oh, and Snowy sleeps in that basket.
While we were going through this, I said to her, without thinking about it too much, Miel, you're going to be such a great mom someday. You're taking such good care of all your creatures. And she immediately turned to me and said, who says I'm going to be a mom someday? You're not a mom. Well, I was really surprised to hear those words coming out of my mouth because I know better than anybody that being a mom isn't the only way to take good care of little creatures.
She took a sugar spoon out of another bowl and began to sprinkle granules.
So I'm getting older now, and the biological choice of whether to reproduce or not is less and less in my hands. But I have no regrets about my decision. It makes me who I am. I've taken this path that's led me from being a motherless child to being something like a childless mother. And the kids in my life teach me just how important that is every day.
Don't you cry.
That was KALW's Julie Kane. She produced that piece in 2008 for a series called B-Side Radio. We'd like to hear your point of view about having or not having children. Say your piece at 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. And we might put you on the air.
Take to the sky.
For those of you who do have little ones, the Bay Area has a lot of preschools for you. There are close to 200 in San Francisco alone. That's not even counting Head Start programs, which operate in all 50 states. Many people believe that Head Start was America's first government-run educational program for young children, and it launched back in 1964. But during World War II, there was an earlier model, and it started right here in the city of Richmond. Sam Redman interviewed students and teachers who were in these prototype child care centers on behalf of the Bancroft Library's Regional Oral History Office at UC Berkeley. Redman recently visited KALW, where he spoke with Stephen Short about the project.
One of the many people that we talked to actually had a pretty multidimensional experience with the schools. A man named Tom Powers was once a student at the centers, but his mom, Ruth Powers, was also a teacher there. So he got an experience from both of those perspectives. But then later he returned while he was in high school, a young man. He became a student teacher there. So he had a perspective then a few years later of what the schools were like.
Well, so let's hear that clip from Tom Powers.
The child care centers, they were all identical in shape and structure. They had the same food. They had the same teaching plans. They were very, everything was done in great detail. And, you know, it turned out that they were very good. Having children do art at age 3 and 4, I mean, that's a, and it was very regimented art programs.
Sam, that was Tom Powers, who started his education in one of these government-run preschool centers. And he mentions that art was very good for these children, but then he also said that it was highly structured. Well, art isn't supposed to be highly structured. I mean, it's supposed to be free, isn't it? Can you explain this?
Sure. So there was a really innovative art practitioner and teacher named Monica Haley, who was introducing ideas about how art was developmental in children. So 2-year-olds, 3-year-olds, and 4-year-olds paint alike and go through various stages of cognitive development, and it's expressed in their art. And the context of wartime influenced this heavily. One of my colleagues at the Oral History Office recorded an interview with Patricia Wilson, who's a former teacher who talks about the art program.
I don't think that there was a focus, but it would happen that the children would be aware. They would hear their parents, or, you know, they knew that this was going on, and they would portray it. Airplanes, dropping bombs, something to do with the theme of warfare, and the teachers would encourage them to express themselves that way.
That was Patricia Wilson telling us about the importance of art in these centers. I'm talking with Sam Redmond, who's from UC Berkeley's Regional Oral History Office. I'm Stephen Short. Now, Sam, what can you tell us about the population that was going to these schools? Who were these families? We've already said they've inundated poor little Richmond.
Right. Well, as we've mentioned, there's actually a great headline for an article that would appear later in Fortune magazine called "Richmond Took a Beating," that I think is actually indicative of the experience of the city. It grew exponentially in terms of population, and about 27% of the workforce at Kaiser were women. And many of these women had children. And many of the women were from California, but many of the women were from elsewhere. And they participated in this massive migration of people to urban centers especially, but many of them out west, Los Angeles and the Bay Area and Seattle, experienced a massive growth along with the defense industries that were growing up and building for this Pacific War. And Richmond especially, it grew in terms of size, but it also grew in terms of diversity of who was there. And many people who moved in were from the Jim Crow South and were of a different racial background and also had a different experiences surrounding race and race relations. We recorded a great interview with a former teacher and a student together, and some of their memories bouncing off one another. It's actually a really great setting. This is an interview with Ruth Hoffman, a former teacher, and O'Neill Dillon, who incidentally became a lead psychiatrist on death row at San Quentin Prison, but is now retired and is incidentally a volunteer at the Rosie the Riveter National Park now. But they shared some of their experiences and recollections about how people got along at the school.
Well, let's hear that now.
We had an incident. We had a new teacher, and she happened to be black, okay? And she was assigned to art room. this one day, I remember the kid, Morgan Cooley. His mother came to pick him up, and the mother said that she was taking him out because of the teacher.
Because she was black?
And I said to her, I'm very sorry to hear it. I said, Morgan was doing very well here, and she is one of our best teachers. And she was. She was really good. 2 weeks later, she comes back with Morgan. Morgan comes back.
That was the voice of Ruth Hoffman, who was a teacher at these child care centers in Richmond during World War II. And that second male voice that you heard was O'Neill Dillon, who was a former student of hers. Well, we're touching on the racial tension that all these people from all over the country and all kinds of creeds, colors, and everything all thrown together into the Great War effort. But certainly there were problems with that. What was the racial climate like in these close quarters in Richmond at that time?
Well, certainly these schools are popping up a full decade before Brown v. Board of Education would change the landscape of schools and the doctrine of separate but equal throughout the country. And certain places had different policies in racial integration, both, by law and both by social practice. But these schools gradually became increasingly diverse. And as the city of Richmond continued to become more and more diverse, they became a space where lots of people could get an early education, including Valvia Jefferson, who was one of the first African-Americans following the Brown v. Board of Education decision to officially start in a program and desegregate these schools. And she had a very interesting experience and remembers very powerfully her feelings and relationship to the school and the community.
At that time, the school was open, right, for the South Side, for Richmond, for the community. That's what it was for. And we bloomed. Everybody that came up out of there was someone we can look or maybe point our finger to. And I'm speaking of more recent, because from there we left and went to the other school, which was Mount Olive. Mm-hmm. And people like our councilman, John Ziesenhenny, the Livingstons, all of them went to that school. So it was like the children, are actually being nurtured all the way up. And these are our kids. Mm-hmm. And I felt as though that was something very special. All of the kids knew that they belonged to somebody.
That's the voice of Valvia Jefferson. She was part of the early child care pilot program in the city of Richmond, which started up during World War II. We heard from historian Sam Redmond, who gathered the recordings you just heard for the Bancroft Library's Regional Oral History Office at UC Berkeley, and he spoke with KALW's Stephen Short. Those recordings will be part of an exhibit you could find on childcare at the Rosie the Riveter National Historical Park in Richmond. The next tour is scheduled for August 21st. This is Cross Currents. I'm Ben Trefney. And before we leave you today, we'd like to share an art exhibit with you that's also exploring concepts of family and home. It's called Solvitur Ambulando,
which translates it as it is solved by walking and just constantly moving, whether because they have to move because of a political situation or could be adoption or because of their choosing.
That's Edward Schocker, a performer with the Thingamajigs. They created this music for the exhibit using strange objects like glass bowls, terracotta pots, flutes, wooden mallets, and the residency at the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive is in collaboration with artist Sasha Hum. Hum considers herself to be a nomad. She was adopted, and her journeys led her to South Korea, where she searched for her birth parents using documents like immunization records and letters. She's put it all together to create the visual component of the exhibit.
My naturalization papers, every positive pregnancy test I've ever had. I think part of this, too, is for me to figure out how to fill, like, what stories go into a book like this. Like, my stories of going back to Korea and searching for my parents. And there's so much that we don't sort of vibe with in modern culture. Like, we don't do well in the cities, My daughters don't do well, My middle child the other day was sitting in the backyard at my mom's house in Berkeley, and she's just sitting there for a while, and I was like, she looks sad. I'm like, what's up, you know? She said, the trees in the city, they don't talk to me. I was like, oh, do they talk to you in the country? She's like, yeah. I was like, oh, okay. I was like, well, why don't you think they talk to you in the city? And she's like, maybe they just don't recognize me as something to talk to. And then she's like listening to like some weed whacker, and she's like, or maybe it's just too noisy.
That's artist Sasha Hum, recorded by KALW's Leela Day. You could see her artwork and hear the music of the Thingamajigs in an exhibit called Solvitur Ambulando, opening this Friday at the Berkeley Art Museum and Pacific Film Archive. Find more information at KALW.org. And that's it for today's Cross Currents from KALW News. Our team includes Hannah Baba, Julie Kane, Jen Sheehan, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Linda Ju, Christina Loring, Alyssa Kapnick, Leah Rose, Stephen Short, Seth Samuel, Resu Sussman, and Daniel Moore. Today's show is engineered by Chris Hoff. Casey Miner is our senior editor. Our managing editor is Martina Castro. Holly Kernan is our news director. And thank you. We are listener-supported radio. The dreamy pop sounds you're hearing now are by Oakland duo Eric and Erica. They not only make music, they also make their flyers and CD sleeves all by hand. Eric and Erica enjoy performing in non-commercial spaces, like somebody's backyard, but tomorrow they'll be at Amnesia in San Francisco starting at 8:30 p.m. For Cross Currents, I'm Ben Trefney.